You'd be surprised by how much they've been reinventing the city of Bristol. England's industrial age powerhouse is refashioning itself into a ship-shaped cultural centre for the southwest of England.
It's a really walkable city, but you can also use our ferries if you want to get your feet onto the water as well.
In northeastern Spain, Barcelona is getting a reputation for being just too popular to handle the demand. To escape the crowds of cruise ship tourists, a local friend can clue you into the neighborhoods where the welcome's still warm and the atmosphere untrampled.
We always can find some of those narrow streets and beautiful areas that you can enjoy.
Or wander through the fairy tale setting of Bruges. It's long been a favorite place to taste the old world pleasures of Belgium and sample its traditions.
Every Belgian beer has to be drunk from a specific glass.
Let's explore Bristol, Barcelona, and Bruges in the hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. We're profiling three distinct styles of European cities today on Travel with Rick Steves. We'll hear how the Catalan culture and Gaudí's groundbreaking architecture conspire to make Barcelona and its Mediterranean setting almost too popular for its population to handle. And we'll check how cobbled streets and medieval buildings reflecting in glassy canals have long given Bruges an atmosphere that makes it a tourist favorite and a cultural center for Western Belgium. Let's start the hour with a city that may be more of a surprise, Bristol in England. It was an industrial age powerhouse, and it's the largest city in the southwest. The River Avon flows in from its elegant neighbor of Bath before emptying into the sea. Early on, Bristol was where the British left to explore the New World. It became a major trading port, which unfortunately also made it a center of Britain's slave trade. It was home to religious reformers John and Charles Wesley, and it's where today's guerrilla street artist Banksy hails from. It's also where Charlie Rawson joins us from now to tell us what makes Bristol worth a visit today.
Hello, I'm very happy to be here.
Isn't it interesting how sometimes you just get sidetracked on the charming town that everybody knows and loves, and that's Bath, you know, and you never get to the other town that's the other side of the cultural coin, like Bristol. How would you compare Bath and Bristol?
So I always think of Bristol as the gritty little sister to Bath, in the same way that Glasgow is the gritty little sister to Edinburgh. It gives us this look into where the money came from for Bath. We get to see the historical context for what created the wonders that are Bath. And then we also have our own little bit of beautiful Georgian architecture up in Clifton as well. So you can get the whole package by coming to Bristol.
We'll talk about Bristol in a sec, but this is something really important to people planning a trip to England. You know, you're going to go to the cute castles and the wonderful nature of Wales, but you've got the gritty side of Wales in the capital city of Cardiff, which in its day was a huge coal port. You've got, of course, all the charm of Edinburgh in Scotland, but half of the ships at sea were built on the River Clyde in Glasgow in its heyday, right? You can go to York and you can go to the Cotswold villages and have all the thatched cuteness that you can imagine. But you can be missing Liverpool, which is a very important city. And all of these industrial, what I call second cities, they seem to be having a renaissance right now. And they're edgy, they're creative, they're not touristy, and they offer a huge and warm welcome to any visitor that wants to venture there. So let's talk about Bristol. Bristol is a city that really was important as part of the infrastructure of England back in the Victorian times. The most important citizen, the most important father of that city was a famous engineer whose name I can never remember. What's this guy's name?
Isambard Kingdom Brunel is the man we are talking about. He was absolutely revolutionary during this time. He was responsible for the Great Western Railway, which came out of London and connected into Bristol. And then he was also responsible for the incredible bridge we have here, which is iconic and historic. So that opened in 1864 it opened. And it's beautiful because it connects North Somerset to Bristol, but it also, it reminds us of the geological landscape that it was reaching across. So it represents so much more across both counties and geology. And it's a great place to meet. In fact, on my wedding day, I took my family up to the middle of that bridge to celebrate. And we had a photograph all together. So we would always remember where we were at that very moment on that day.
What's the name of this bridge we're talking about?
It's the Clifton Suspension Bridge.
The Clifton Suspension Bridge, another suspension bridge in Bristol. And we're looking and marveling at the industrial energy of England in the Victorian age. That was that age when England was the first global superpower. Queen Victoria famously, her realm was famously the empire upon which the sun never set. And we have her initiative and England's initiative to connect the two great cities, London and New York, in a modern way. And that meant you could leave London and take an express train for the day directly to Bristol. And you would then have an iron-hulled steamship that could motor you across the Atlantic and get to New York in unthinkable speed back then. A train ride connecting with a great ship. And today, as a tourist, you can see that great ship. It's the SS Great Britain, right?
It is indeed. The SS Great Britain is a wonderful vessel to go and explore. They even have actors who dress up as Brunel and talk about the engineering and the heritage. There's a really great Brunel museum there about his life and all of the things that he's contributed to engineering. But just walking around the vessel itself, it's awe-inspiring. And it actually sat for many years, about 30 years, over by the Falkland Islands. And it was wrecked there for such a long time. And we're so grateful for the fact that it was brought back, it was renovated, and now we can all visit this incredible ship.
Oh, I love it. Now, if you move way ahead to this same sort of edgy, industrial, gritty city, we have a city in Bristol, your hometown, the city we're talking about. What is it, 2 or 3 hours by train from London?
Yeah, so it's about, it's actually about an hour and a half to 2 hours. It's not very far at all. It's about 15 minutes from Bath. So it really is so accessible.
And you've got a city now there that has that industrial heritage and takes it up to the present day with world-class street art. It took me a while to warm up to street art, you know, but especially in Britain. When you go to Glasgow, when you go to Belfast, when you go to Bristol, when you go to Liverpool, these industrial towns we're talking about, they have made graffiti into a high art form with some kind of government oversight. I mean, the government doesn't, everything's going to get tagged anyways. Why not mobilize these high energy artists that have something to say? This is people's art, if ever there was people's art. Give them a big hunk of building and say, okay, do something. And
very
it's beautiful,
so.
Isn't it?
Yeah, we have a great festival here called Upfest, and that takes place. It started back in 2008 by local street artists, and now it's an international festival. It's the largest in Europe for street art, and it's well worth coming along to check out the art that's made from it.
And don't you have a local boy made, you could say good, but we don't know him for sure, named Banksy in Bristol?
Absolutely. Banksy is from Bristol, or Bedminster, in fact, Bedmo, which is a part of Bristol. Well, we say he. Is it a he? Is it a girl? Is it a she? Is it a they? We don't know. It could be a group of people. I mean, I went to the fantastic Banksy show that was up in Glasgow last year, and I'm pretty sure it is a he. And I think I know someone that knows him. So I...
Well, what I know is you can see him or their or she's art on the streets of Bristol, along with a lot of other great art. This is Travel with Rick Steves, and we are joined by Charlie Rawson. And Charlie is a tour guide who just gets so much passion and puts that into her work. She loves taking people around Britain, and her hometown is Bristol. And I get a sense that she feels like Bristol deserves a little more love from the international tourism crowd. And we're learning why right now. You can learn more about Charlie and her work on Instagram at Charlie_Rawson. So Charlie, after 20 years of updating my Bath chapter in my Rick Steves England and my Rick Steves Britain guidebooks, I finally took a day out of Bath to visit all the things that I have visited every couple of years for decades. And I thought, I'm going to go to this mysterious town I've heard about, but I've never been to, Bristol. I got on that train, and in half an hour, I was on the street in Bristol with a good local guide from Bristol. It was the most exhilarating day of my entire trip because I was in a new town realizing what took me so long. And I just had the most wonderful time. I took one of those guided walks to see the street art. It was great. I visited the SS Great Britain and I learned about the engineer Islambard Kingdom Brunel. And I also found a fascinating food truck, food court, food festival. It was like a corral of containers, shipping containers, sorts of trendy little eateries and a very, very cool vibe. Tell us about that scene in Bristol.
it goes hand in hand with our creative and edgy, progressive scene that we have here. As a post-industrial city, many creatives came here in the 80s and 90s because land or properties were cheap, because it was a post-industrial place to be. So the actual site that you're talking about with these wonderful containers called Cargo, it's built on an old car park. So it was absolutely useless space prior. It didn't really get used very much and it wasn't really in the nicest place to hang out. Now you have these old shipping containers, which have been turned into wonderful independent eateries and restaurants. One of them is even in the Michelin book. So it really is a superb place to go and check out, down right on the harbour front, where you can then jump on a ferry and head down to another bit of Bristol. It's a really walkable city, but you can also use our ferries if you want to get your feet onto the water as well.
And you can imagine what a bonanza that was for me, because I was having one day suddenly turned on to Bristol and I had to write a chapter for my book. And it's very rare that I add a whole new city to a new edition of a book.
Yeah.
I had to get it in. We have since gone back and made better coverage. But all I needed to say was, Cargo, baby. Go to Cargo.
Gotta be there.
And you've got a whole array of different options. Charlie Rawson is joining us from Bristol, letting us in on the appeal of the city's post-industrial charm on Travel with Rick Steves. Charlie specializes in tours of southwest England, plus hiking and yoga trips, and she's an enthusiast of paddleboarding and wild swimming in the sea. Her website is travelwithcharlierawson.com. That's Charlie, spelled C-H-A-R-L-I-E. I know from your own enthusiastic reporting that you're into hot air ballooning. And with all these other attractions in Bristol, you've got a very popular balloon festival each August. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a wonderful festival that was set up by Don Cameron, who also has a hot air balloon manufacturing facility in Bristol. It really is the ballooning mecca of the UK. And it's a fabulous place to come and see this gorgeous skyscape in the morning with the balloons dotted and flying over the city. And if you get the opportunity to take a flight from the Fiesta surrounded by all these other balloons, it is just an experience like no other.
You know, Charlie Rawson, we're going to have to do an interview on Bath just to help them get back some of their tourism, because your enthusiasm, if anybody's listening to this, is going to make Bath a side trip from Bristol. Can you imagine that?
Crikey, bring it on.
Cranky. Well, I don't want to get all my friends in Bath upset, because they got more bed and breakfast there than they've got people. But I do want to remind people, when you're going to Bath, hey, it's a twofer. You got Bath and Bristol. It's like a little city bus ride apart, but it's a train. And every half an hour, you got that 15-minute train connection between Bath and Bristol. You could be sleeping in Bath, you could spend the morning in Bristol, and you'd get over there intending to spend the morning in the Bristol, and you would come back after dinner that night, I can promise you, if you got your act together and know what all there is to see. Charlie Rawson, thanks so much for sharing with us a little insight into perhaps a new dimension of traveling in England. Hope to see you there.
Very happy to do so. Hope to see you soon.
Thanks, Charlie.
Oh, the factories may be roaring with the boom-a-lack-a-zoom-a-lack-a-wee. But there isn't any roar when the clock strikes four. Everything stops for tea.
Our next stops are Barcelona in Spain's Catalunya and Bruges in the country of Belgium. Glad you can be with us today on Travel with Rick Steves. Barcelona is so popular with tourists, and for good reason. Situated in the heart of Catalunya, this trendy Spanish city beckons travelers with its lively streets, tapas dining scene, Art Nouveau architecture, and beautiful Mediterranean beaches. And don't forget Gaudí. But Barcelona's mass tourist appeal has drawn criticism and backlash from locals in recent years. But that doesn't stop people from continuing to visit the Catalan capital and the surrounding region. Here to update us on Barcelona and Catalunya is Spanish tour guide Jesus Ruiz. Jesus, tell me your name in a good Spanish accent.
You know, it's Jesus Ruiz. It's, well, first of all, thank you for having me here.
Yeah.
I'm sorry that my name has all the hard and
I was going to say, sounds. It's like there's letters and sounds and percussion. It's the whole percussion section in your mouth.
Exactly. So you have it right there when you want to pronounce Spanish.
So we have like, it's like Jesus Ruiz.
Exactly.
Now, and how would you say that in Spanish?
Jesus Ruiz.
Let's go to Barcelona. Decided to live in Barcelona. What is it? It's very popular with tourists, but for a local person, why did you choose to live in Barcelona?
Well,
for many reasons, I had been, you know, I started being a guide in when we had the Olympic Games in Barcelona. Yeah. I had been to Barcelona before, but there was something special about that city that
attracted me. That was more than 30 years ago.
Yes.
So you must have been a young guy.
So, yeah.
And it was a big deal. I remember there were special books out.
Oh,
Barcelona.
Goodness.
It was the new beginning of Barcelona. And it was also Visca Catalunya.
Oh, Visca Catalunya. Yes.
But this was after Franco, so you could wave the Catalunian flag.
Absolutely, yeah. Franco died in 1975. And until that, you better not wave that Catalan flag, because otherwise you were in trouble.
So let's talk about that, because that is interesting. And just on my first visits to Spain when I was a student, it was before 1975, and Spain was under a fascist dictatorship.
Oh, yeah.
Franco is from the class of Mussolini and Hitler, and Salazar in Portugal. And Catalonian people have an indelible spirit. I mean, there's a big, strong national pride, but they could not speak the Catalan language.
Yeah.
They couldn't dance the Catalan dances. They couldn't wave the Catalonian flag.
No, they could not. They were risking to be being arrested.
Yeah.
You were doing that.
I understand you could wave the Catalan soccer team flag.
Yeah, the Barça, the Barcelona. But that's how the Barça, we say Barça for Barcelona soccer team, became also kind of like a national pride. I mean, not national, Catalan pride, I should say.
Catalan pride, yeah.
Catalan
that's
pride.
What we should remember is, if you ask somebody who lives in Barcelona, what country do you live in?
Obviously, Spain. Spain is divided into 17 different regions or autonomous communities, and Catalonia is one of them, located in the northeast of Spain.
But some people could be loyal to the identity of Catalonian.
Absolutely.
More than Spanish.
Oh, yeah.
So Catalan is distinct from Spain. Tell me a little bit about the language and the culture that is different from what we think of as Spanish.
Well, obviously, Catalonia is part of Spain, and we have there a lot of things that are very similar, but at the same time, very many things that they are very different. Sometimes some of the traditions of the language, it's a little bit closer to French, because obviously we are very close to the Pyrenees, very close to France, and sometimes closer to Spanish as far as the language is concerned. I mean, Catalan is a Latin language.
I had that sense when I'm in Barcelona, it's like halfway culturally between Madrid and Paris.
Exactly.
The language, the culture, the joy of life, the elegance.
Elegance, exactly. Actually, when you're walking, especially in the Eixample, the new part of town that we call the enlargement of the city, that we call Eixample, right by the main square of the city, along Paseo de Gracia, it looks very French.
When I was in Barcelona a long time ago, I said, so you're a region of Spain. He goes, no, we're not a region of Spain. We are a nation without a state.
Exactly.
That was the phrase. We are a nation without a state.
State.
It's the nationality of the Catalonian people that happened to be in the modern political entity of Spain. And it's a complicated thing because most Catalonians, they don't want to be turn their back entirely on Spain. They just want to be respected for their autonomy. But see the practicality and the brotherhood of being part of Spain. Tell me a little bit about that struggle, because when you have a plebiscite, you know, it's yes or no, independence or not independence. But it's too bad there's not more gradients in that.
Exactly. It's very complex, the situation that we have in Catalonia right now. We have to go back to the Middle Ages. Obviously, we don't have time to be talking about this, but it's because when the Iberian Peninsula was divided into a mosaic of different kingdoms, one of those kingdoms was Aragon. Catalonia was part, I mean, the counties that we had for Catalonia was part of that kingdom. Two of the most powerful kingdoms, Aragon and Castile, they united because there was a wedding there, Isabel and Fernando, right? And it all comes with that. They united, but they remained being kind of like independent.
They were united by marriage.
By marriage in this time. I mean,
and that plants the seeds of perhaps future problems.
Exactly.
Because the people didn't do that marriage. Their king or their queen did. And that was the choice that generations later saddles these people with the fact that the capital city and the king is in Madrid.
Exactly.
Jesus Ruiz is our guide to visiting Barcelona and the Catalan region of northeast Spain right now on Travel with Rick Steves. When he's not leading tours, Jesus divides his time between his home in Barcelona and his birthplace of Segovia. He's a tour guide who earned a doctorate in Madrid studying the history and characteristics of the English language. You'll find more about Barcelona at ricksteves.com. Jesus, when we're talking about Catalonian independence, Spain has had a long history of separatist groups. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately for Madrid, two of the industrial powerhouses of their country are Basque Country and Catalonia.
Exactly.
So they can't just cut away some backward corner of the country. This is the industrial heartland. This is the Ruhr Valley or the Detroit and the industrial center of Spain. And it happens to be in corners of the country where people have different loyalties and different language and different heritage, Basque and Catalonia. So Catalan knows that it has plenty of power, plenty of options, plenty of pride. They've had a difficult time with Franco and the fascism period. Mm-hmm. And now there's this question going on. Tell us the latest on this issue, because you're probably a typical Catalonian, you know, a Spaniard who has moved in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because being born, especially in Castile, because, you know, there was always the problem that between the central government, which is in Castile, I mean, in
Madrid.
Madrid, obviously, yeah. And Catalonia. But anyway, the latest one, well, there's still a big debate right now going on. And we had elections in Catalonia. And it's very interesting because for the very first time in many years, let's say the winner party is not an independentist
really?
Party.
Really? Okay, so
yes.
It's a loyalist.
Exactly. So well, they're now trying to make a coalition with some of the independents. So it's quite difficult. But the good thing, Rick, nowadays is that they are sitting down and talking, they didn't some years ago. So
very important. And I think this is a very important thing to stress. The tourist might see demonstrators on the street mm-hmm. corner that are kind of angry and extremist and waving their Catalonian flag. Mm-hmm. But if you ask the typical Catalonian, do you want to break away from Madrid entirely? They would say no. What they want is more autonomy, more ability to make the things that make sense to be deliberated in their region from Barcelona, not from Madrid.
Exactly. One of the very important things that it's something that the Basque country has nowadays is their own fiscal system, pretty much. I mean, maybe it won't be the same one,
yeah,
but something similar. And this is very good for Catalonia.
Hey, when we're going to Barcelona, what as a tour guide, what are a couple of the essential sites? Just in 1 minute, can you give me a description of what do we do in Barcelona?
Oh, my goodness. There's so much to see. And the great thing about Barcelona is the contrasts. I love architecture, history, art, languages, and everything. You can find all that in Barcelona just by walking down the old town that you have all the...
That's the Gothic quarter?
Exactly.
So it's Gothic everywhere you look?
Gothic.
On top of Roman ruins?
And on top of Roman ruins, we take our groups over there to see this amazing part of the town. But right there, we have the main square, and that's where the old medieval city walls used to be. And right by it, we have all these wonderful Art Nouveau, we say modernist buildings.
Yeah. Modernist would be, that's modernismo, is
exactly.
The, like Jugendstil would be the German word for Art Nouveau.
Exactly.
And that would be the art of around what, about 1900 or something like that?
Exactly. Late 1800s, yeah. Beginning of the 1900s. Yeah. And that's where we had those wonderful buildings built
Gaudi. What I love about Art Nouveau in Barcelona, it's architects that most Americans don't know the name. And there's several architects that are really important, but only one has an easy name to say, Gaudí, Antonio Gaudí.
Exactly.
But tell me very clearly so I can hear the names, three important modernist architects.
Well, it's Domènec i Muntaner. And Puig i Cadafalch.
Puig i Cadafalch.
It's true. They're difficult. Maybe, I mean, they were all geniuses. They were all wonderful architects, but Gaudí got the... how would you say?
He was a good promoter, I think.
He had
to raise money to do the Sagrada Familia.
Oh, yes.
So he knew how to finish one facade early so he could have a home show and bring in the potential supporters. And he did a good job of that, I think.
It's amazing, Rick, because obviously the icon of Barcelona is this incredible temple, the Sagrada Familia. We say expiatory temple. So it's a temple that belongs to everyone. Right.
And we're helping pay for it.
Absolutely.
You got to fund these things. It's not like in the Middle Ages when everybody gave all their money to the church.
Yeah, exactly.
So we have to help pay for it. So you can complain about the high cost to see the Sagrada Familia Church, which I think is one of the most breathtaking churches, places of worship in Europe.
Amazing.
And we're helping finish it. Gaudí, I believe, died in 1926.
Exactly, 1926.
And now, 2026, the centennial of his death.
Yes.
The hope is to get it finished, or what's the plan?
I don't think so. The problem is because of COVID, there were a couple of years there that there was not much work and obviously no income.
Because they were on track to get it done for the centennial of Gaudí's
Exactly.
death.
They wanted to celebrate the 100 years. So,
but it is consecrated where you can go to a mass there and it's worshiping going on, and it is the most organic modern church architecture. There's something about it. You feel like you're in a holy jungle.
Totally. I love that. Holy jungle.
You can use that.
I love it. And it's also the colors, depending on the time of the day that you are there and you're walking through.
It's like the sun shining through a canopy in the jungle.
Yeah. Yes.
And these organic columns go up the top and they sprout like a palm tree.
Exactly.
Our guide to the distinctive sites of Barcelona and the surrounding Catalan region of Spain is Jesus Ruiz, right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Jesus, there's a crowding problem in Barcelona because your city is so darn fun and beautiful and attractive. Everybody's going there. It's trendy now, isn't it?
We all want to be there. Yes. I think it's happened in some other cities in other parts of the world, right? But Barcelona, you know, it's right by the Mediterranean. It's a great city. You have all these great monuments and sites and everything. And the
great food, great love of life, dancing in the streets. You know.
And dancing in the streets. And we like to make these human castles that we call the human castles and everything.
If you're in tourism, you say, well, these are the people who butter my bread. You know, these are the people that come and help me pay my bills. And because they stay in the hotels, they eat at the restaurants and they buy our souvenirs and they take our tours. But if you're not in tourism, you think sometimes, hey, this is my city. And now it's been given to the tourists.
Right. We had some problems in the past with some demonstrations. I have to tell you that I was a bit embarrassed, not because of the demonstrations, right? Because some of the locals were complaining about it's just... we had that problem that because of the massive tourism, some of the prices of the apartments to live for the locals, it's impossible. So they have to go away.
And that becomes a vicious cycle because it drives away the people who live in the Gothic Quarter, for example, or who live along the Ramblas.
Exactly.
And then there's no more basis for local businesses. So all the business morph from serving local residents to serving tourists who are visiting. And then what was a cute district with an honest-to-goodness culture and community and and commerce, it becomes sort of a la-la land for tourists.
Absolutely. And I still recommend, you know, that you do come to Barcelona to visit us because, yes, there are crowds, but, you know, we always can find some of those narrow streets and beautiful areas that you can enjoy. So please,
Jesus, it's such a delight talking to you. And if we could just finish, cap it off for our conversation with one advice from you over how, as we visit Barcelona, knowing we're going to line up with all the other tourists to see the famous sites, but if we want to do one thing that distinguishes our trip so that we have just a beautiful moment, an intimate moment with the local culture, how would you do that and where would you do that?
I always recommend my groups because obviously they want to see the big sites. I always recommend to go to one of the neighborhoods like Gracia or my neighborhood, which is called Poblenou. Uh-huh. Poblenou is the area where we had the textile industry, the factories in Barcelona, and now they renovated it for the Olympic Games in 1992. I love the atmosphere there because it's a mix of the locals, the elderly couples
that
go for a paseo, for a stroll, and then some of the newcomers, like people, young kids from other parts of Europe or other parts of the world, they come to work there in this district. And it's
so beautiful. And that's where you live. What is the name of that district?
Poblenou. Poblenou, it's in Catalan. Literally translated means the new town.
The new town, okay.
It's the new town that they built outside of the city walls of Barcelona.
Is it near the harbor?
It's near, very near the beach.
Yeah.
We also have
because that's a grid plan. If you look at it, it's a checkerboard grid.
Exactly.
So if you look at a very strict checkerboard street plan near the water, that would be Poblenou where you're talking about. And if you look for a little higgly-piggly break in the grid plan of the Eixample, that is the old village of Gracia that you mentioned.
Exactly.
And then you can see by looking at the map, you've got this one medieval tangle of lanes, and then there's been a rising tide of structure and rigidity in these, you know, checkerboard street plan of the Eixample. In the middle of that was the town that was there before the Eixample.
Exactly.
And that's Gracia, and Gracia has that characteristic of a small town.
Absolutely. It used to be a small town, and now it's one of the
survives.
Neighborhoods.
Right? Yeah,
it's,
as a neighborhood. Jesus Ruiz. Jesus Ruiz.
Muy bien.
I was going to say gracias, but in Catalan?
Moltas gracias. It's very similar.
Oh,
you can say
you
can either say moltas gracias is thank you very much, right? You can either say gracias or merci.
Merci, that's right. Merci. That's that French
exactly.
connection. That's what I remember. When
exactly.
I'm in Catalan, I say merci,
merci.
The French version. And also when I want to say I love this place, I say visca Catalunya.
Visca Catalunya.
Hey, thanks so much. And we'll
Thank
see you in
you
Barcelona.
Thank you so much, Rick. Thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Some of our Travel with Rick Steves listeners like to tell us about their travels in the form of a haiku poem. Here's a few interesting ones they've recently sent us.
Sherry Seetaler from La Jolla, California, tells us that a journey with her 14-and-a-half-year-old Vizsla Mix rescue dog named Ruby inspired this haiku. Ruby has accompanied Sherry for more than 20,000 miles over the years, but now she needs some accommodation in the form of a big, classy dog stroller, in which she's reported to ride with the greatest of dignity. Old dog's chariot, noble in your last travels, like Cleopatra. Carla Richmond of Bellingham, Washington, had a bird's eye view on a famous island in the Bay of Naples. On Capri's chairlift, feet grazing tops of vineyards, wine futures below. And Richard Cross from Arlington, Texas, tells us about an impulse purchase he made while in Italy. Visit Modena, see the Maserati shop, bring back a red one.
Hey, Rick Steves here. In 1978, I was a 23-year-old piano teacher dreaming of the fabled hippie trail from Istanbul to Kathmandu. With my buddy Gene, we booked the tickets, packed our rucksacks, and set out on the adventure of a lifetime. My new book, On the Hippie Trail, features my 60,000-word journal and vivid photos of my coming-of-age trip. Squeeze into rickshaws, sail the sacred Ganges, and look into the eyes of the Virgin Goddess as you stow away with me on the legendary Hippie Trail. You can pre-order my book, On the Hippie Trail, right now by following the link at ricksteves.com. And if you do, I'll send you a postcard with access to special bonus content.
I'm Tali Bečilević. I'm coming from Sarajevo, capital of Bosnia, where I work as a local guide and as a journalist. We have many proverbs, like the rest of the Balkans. And for this time, I will use one journalist one. We will say like, Sloboda govora je zajamčena, ali ne I sloboda poslije govora. There is a guarantee for the freedom of speech, but not the freedom after the speech. Sloboda govora je zajamčena, ali ne I sloboda nakon govora.
A combination of heavy-hitting medieval history and modern-day pleasures makes Bruges the kind of city where you don't mind being a tourist. Bruges tour guide Nico Favaril is joining us to provide an insider's view on what to see and what to do to enjoy the charming architecture, the Flemish art, the mussels and the frites, that's the French fries, the chocolate and the beer that make Bruges an ideal old-world getaway. Nico, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So tell me about your work and what it's like to be a guide in Bruges.
It's great. It's a city that most people are very excited about to see. So as soon as you meet a group, for instance, for a guided tour of Bruges or a longer stay, they're already excited to be there.
Oh, yeah.
It's not a place where they've never heard of, so you already have that. It's also an easy city to guide in because it's there, the beauty is there. It has a lot of history. Every corner has a house with something that you could talk about.
It feels almost fanciful.
It is. It is. For a lot of Flemish people who may not work in tourism, they think it's an open-air museum and kind of avoid it a little bit.
It is pretty sweet. I mean, it's filled with tourists and, you know, sugary examples of clichetic Belgian culture.
Yes, we have a few temptation streets, as we call them, but they're not filled with...
drugs and prostitutes.
No, they're filled
that's
with chocolates and beer, and it's quite tempting. Yes.
So, and you've got this amazing cathedral that just rockets up in the center, that spire made out of bricks. It's just awe-inspiring.
Yeah, it's the Church of Our Lady, the Notre Dame, basically. Yeah. The cathedral is a little bit further up, but the Church of Our Lady is the one that everybody sees from a far distance.
Yeah.
It's like Lego bricks.
When you look at that tower, it looks like a skyscraper.
It
made
is.
Out of bricks,
yes.
But it's a church spire.
It's amazing. And nowadays we have, of course, a lot of buildings. But if you would have arrived in Bruges, say, in the early Middle Ages, you would have seen that church tower from miles and miles ahead.
And people traveled a lot of times for religious purposes back then.
They did.
And you'd be walking, and from far in the distance, you'd see that spire, and you go, our destination.
And that's a way of... showing where trade was done, if you had a big spire.
And then you step inside and you find a Michelangelo statue.
Yes.
I think it's the only Michelangelo in Northern Europe. That's sort of an indication of how important Bruges was.
It is.
Not just a tourist town. Mm. It had a Michelangelo.
And it was a purchase. It wasn't really given to the church or so. It was someone who traveled, traded with north of Italy and got the statue.
Now, across from the church, there's a beautiful bridge. I mean, every bridge in Bruges just seems like it's made for a painter to set up an easel and paint it. But then beyond that, there's a little dock and small touristic boats that take people around. What would you find when you get on one of those boats?
Yeah, you have five stops that... basically give you the same experience. So every boat does the same tour. It's a 45-minute tour. I mean, they're not covered, so you have to be lucky with the weather, but it's a must. The queues can be quite long, so maybe you want to call ahead.
Bruges is crowded, so you want to go early or go late. A lot of times, you know, it's crowded in the middle of the day, but it's remarkable how quiet it gets later on. And if things are open until 7 o'clock, try them at 6 o'clock.
Yeah, definitely. And on beautiful sunny days... You know, the Belgians in general, if they can make business, they will stay open a bit longer.
Yeah.
So if there's still good weather and large crowds, they will still go on.
The Belgians, if they're able to stay open longer. So are you saying that the Belgians are like good merchants?
Yeah, good. Yeah. I mean, we see this
business
in
people.
Yeah, in a town like Brussels, which is, of course, not Bruges, bars open until customers are there.
I was thinking the Dutch are famously frugal and hardworking and so on. But when you think about Belgium, it's sort of a split society. Half of it is Walloon and French, and half of it is Flemish and more Dutch, speaking the same language as they speak in the Netherlands.
Yes.
What is Bruges? What part of Belgium?
So Bruges is a Flemish city.
Okay.
It's Flanders can be a historical concept, and Bruges was a very important part of historic Flanders.
Yeah.
But it's now the most touristy city of the Dutch-speaking region of Belgium, which is also called Flanders.
Now, when you get on that little boat, Nico, you sail by, it's sort of a parallel world. There's none of the crowds, it's just you, well, it's a gang of tourists on the boat, but you've got ivy-covered brick walls, and you've got all sorts of beautiful courtyards and underbridges, and what's the highlight of that boat for you? What do you enjoy?
There's a little point where the boat turns around, and you can see how far the canal still stretch. So even though the boat doesn't get you there, it gives you... the idea of maybe I should come back to this area and walk around and stroll along the canals.
So it's a nice overview and you get some ideas. And it is a reminder, if you just walk three or four blocks away from all of the tourism, it does get more peaceful and it's actually residential. And you see people living in 400-year-old brick homes. It's just actually quite quaint and charming and, as we were saying, almost fanciful. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Nico Favaril, and Nico is a guide from Belgium. He lives just a few miles away from Bruges, and he takes Americans around this beautiful city. Also, across from that big church that we were talking about, right next to the boat docks there, there's it's like a medieval hospital. This is, to me, fascinating to think that religion and medicine and art, it kind of mixed together. What do we find when we step inside?
It is a hospital where people were brought... to be taken care of most of the time at the end of their life in those days. So very religious. the nice thing is, because of the religion linked to the hospital, you have a lot of religious art. And the contributor of religious art is Hans Memling. It's not so, not really considered a hospital museum, but it's more the Memling Museum.
So it was a hospital. It has this Gothic feeling of mm-hmm. old Bruges. But if you like Memling, and if you don't know Memling, Memling is sort of the quintessential Flemish artist, isn't
yes.
he?
Yeah, very detailed as well.
Exquisite, the detail.
And apparently he was sick and was taken care of in the hospital. And as a kind of gesture, he donated some of his best work.
You got to check that out. Now, everything we've been talking about is within 100 meters of each other right now.
Yes.
The church, the little canal tour, and the Memlings, and yeah. this medieval hospital. And that's just the beginning of Bruges. And it's all contained in a beautiful wall surrounded by a canal.
Yes.
And it's just a delightful opportunity. It's about an hour away from Brussels. You can get there from Amsterdam quite easily. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Nico Vavarillo, our friend from Belgium, the Dutch half of Belgium. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. You can email us at radio@ricksteves.com. And Jim's calling in from Colorado Springs in Colorado. Jim, thanks for your call. Have you been to Bruges?
I have, Rick. My wife and I went a couple of years ago and had a wonderful experience in Bruges. Beautiful city, beautiful scenery, took some great photos. And one of the things we discovered was Burt Café. It was called the Oxtedag, and I'm not sure exactly what the translation for that is, but it's one of those 400-year-old homes that you talked about.
Uh-huh.
And it was just outside the old city gates. And the woman invited us in, and we had a lovely aperitif in the afternoon with her.
And this is the Burt Café.
It's called Burt Café, yes.
Burt
it's
Café.
Now, Wharfstraat 3 yeah. in Bruges.
Wharfstraat. Well, it must have been on a canal then. Bruges comes from the same word as
Brugge.
Brugge.
Which, I mean, there's a bit of it sounds very much like the current name for bridge, Brugge.
Okay.
But it may be derived from a docking spot. Yeah. And then an old Celtic word, also Vikings use it, like Bergen
in Norway. Same thing.
So a docking spot, yes.
So, Nico, Jim went to this, sounds like a wonderful family-run, elegant restaurant in an old home. And when I'm updating my guidebook, I'm always spending the evenings looking for restaurants that are good value. And, you know, you got the high rent restaurants in the main square. But if you walk farther away, as Jim did, you find wonderful architecture, old homes, and hardworking entrepreneurial restaurateurs.
Mm-hmm.
And always in Bruges, there's new restaurants popping up. And it's just a delightful dimension of the travels there. Jim, when you were in Bruges, what else do you remember as a highlight?
Well, obviously, the tour of the brewery, which has been there for 400 years. It was an amazing tour. It's been to a lot of breweries, obviously, but this one was rather unique because of the age.
This is the, it used to be Strafe Hendrik, right?
The Halve Maan Brewery.
Okay.
So where they have the Strong Henry, the Straffe Henry,
yeah.
which is one of the beers that
it's a great beer.
It's a great beer.
But what's really cool about this is you take the tour, and it's just a fun-loving tour, isn't it, Jim?
Very nice, yeah. Very, very cordial and very friendly and very personal.
And you see the actual beer making process, and of course, at the end, you've worked up this amazing thirst, and you've got to drink what they've been making there. And they have this beautiful, beautiful lobby where you enjoy that beer. I treat myself to that tour after a long day of researching in Bruges. It is a highlight. Jim, thanks for your call.
Thank you, Rick, and thank you for your help with our touring.
You bet. Thanks for traveling with us. Nico Vavarillo is our guide on Travel with Rick Steves to the historic and charming city of Bruges in western Belgium. Nico lives just outside the city and also works as a Dutch and German and French and English-speaking translator and a language trainer. Catherine's calling in from Decorah in Iowa. Catherine, thanks for your call.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What are your memories of Bruges?
Well, Bruges is one of my favorite spots in all of Europe. I just love the history and the charm of the architecture. I happened to, when I was there a couple of years ago, visited a spot that's not in the very center of Old Town, but which I thought was very special. And I'm probably going to mispronounce it, but the name is Princely Bezenage ten Vigerard. And obviously, Nico can correct my pronunciation.
So, but it's a Bezenage.
It's a Bezenage.
It's a Bezenage, yes.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that it was originally built for a group of pious women, and then over time has become the home for Benedictine nuns. But it's this wonderful old complex of about 30 homes and a church, and all of the buildings are white, and they're sort of built around a common green area, and it just has this wonderful historical contemplative sort of feel about it. And it was quiet and peaceful, and just I felt like I was stepping back in time.
Medieval
time, and just very special, and only about a 10 or 15 minute walk from the main part of the old town. So it was very easy to get to and definitely worth the walk.
Yes, Catherine, this is one of the highlights of this part of Europe, really. And in Bruges, they've got these wonderful béguinages, and it's a home of the Beguines. And back then, there was a lot of reasons men would go off and die. And there was a lot of women, unattached women, and there was a lot of poverty and so on. And the church would take them in and give them a courtyard, and they would be religious lay people, I guess.
Yeah, and they could leave whenever they want. They didn't have to take the vows, but right. They took care of the sick, the elderly, and they lived in a more safe, secure spot. That's why it's in Bruges specifically. You have it surrounded by a wall. There's a little gate that you can go in. So in the older times when they lived together, they were safe from all the dangers outside of it.
And when a visitor goes in, there's still people living there, and you feel like folding your hands and whispering.
Yeah.
Yes, you do. It does. It feels very contemplative and very peaceful. Yeah, just a very special experience. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's a sweet dimension of Bruges that the adventurous tourist enjoys. And good for you, Catherine, for finding that. Thanks for your call.
Oh, thanks.
Okay, bye now.
Bye.
Nico Favarillo manages land and river cruise tours in Germany and the Low Countries. He's with us on Travel with Rick Steves to tell us about his home port of Bruges. It's a charming time warp in the West Flanders part of Belgium. And Marty's on the line from Atlanta. Marty, have you been to Bruges?
I have, Rick, and I love it. I was there with a girlfriend about 6 or 7 years ago, and this year I get to go back with my husband, which will bring a whole new dimension to it.
Nice.
I'm getting all sorts of ideas from Nico. Thank you. I love the architecture. I went from Amsterdam to Bruges, and in each little town, the architecture got older and older, and Bruges was the pinnacle, I guess, of the medieval architecture. There are a lot of houses that open a room as a B&B, and I did that last time. I'm doing it again, and it's a very warm population, I would say. And
you know, Marty, it's a population that welcomes the tourist, and the tourists are part of the economy. So if you're a simple person on the outside of town and you've got a house that's too big for your family and you're an empty nester, you'll rent out rooms to tourists. And I like to rent a bicycle and establish a home in a bed and breakfast like that, Airbnb or whatever. And then with your bicycle, you can just explore. You can bike around the moat. You can see the windmills. You can drop in on the ladies making lace. It's just like a fantasy for a tourist. What are a couple of the visits that you made? Did you go to any little museums that you would recommend?
We did. My girlfriend and I got all three food groups handled in one day. The first visit was to the Choco Story, which is a chocolate museum.
Right.
And, of course, there's tastings at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, we went to the Friet Museum, which is a museum about potatoes and French fries. And, of course, we had lunch, and they eat their French fries with different condiments than we're used to, so that was fun to explore.
So instead
that.
Of ketchup, mayonnaise is the default, isn't it?
It is, and then they flavor the mayonnaise with different things.
Right.
And my first time I heard mayonnaise, I thought, oh, that's so gross.
Oh.
But it's delicious.
Yeah, so give it a try. And if you want your tomato sauce, you can have that, or you can have different spicy ketchups. You know, the Chocolate Story and the French Fries Museum, those are commercial ventures. You know, they're just making money, but they're entertaining. Did you find those were worth the money, or did you find that they were gimmicky?
Both. We did not go into Bruges 6 years ago with your book, which was a mistake. So this time when we go, we will really have more of an idea of what we will do. You know, one of those experiences is fine. You know, I want to go off the beaten path. I loved hearing Nico talk about the boat trip and then seeing... I'm going to do that. I've done the boat trip, but I'm going to do the walk after the boat trip and really get into the neighborhoods. That's what travel is for me, is really absorbing what it's like to live in this place.
That sounds great. Marty, thanks for your call, and have a good next visit to Bruges.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye, Rick.
Bye now. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Nico Favaril. He's our guide from Bruges in Belgium. And Nico, there's so much to talk about in Bruges. The carillon, they've got this wonderful carillon is like a keyboard set up to all the bells. Mm-hmm. And you can actually climb up another tower in the town.
Yes.
And you can, I met the carilloner, the man who plays the carillon, and they don't play with their fingers. They pound it with their fists when they're closed with their little finger hitting the keyboard.
Yeah.
And I shook his hand, and his little finger was twice as wide as a normal little finger because it was so calloused from a lifetime of pounding those keys.
Did he allow you to play the carillon?
He didn't, but he invited me to come to the concert night in the courtyard at the base of the tower, a free concert. And he stuck his head out the window from the top of that tower and he waved at us. And it was such a delightful experience. And let's just finish one more dimension of the city that we haven't talked about. Is the beer. And when I go to Bruges, I meet a lot of Americans, especially from the East Coast, that are on like 3-day beer pilgrimage tours, just flying from New York to Bruges to enjoy the beer.
Yeah.
How do you enjoy the beer in Bruges?
Well, there's a place, it's a shop which just sells Belgian products.
Mm-hmm.
But at the entrance, you have a big wall. It's called the famous beer wall. We have about 1,000 Belgian beers, and almost, I wouldn't say all of them, but most of them are in that wall showing the bottle and the glass from which the beer is drunk, because every Belgian beer has to be drunk from a specific glass.
Because I went to one of these pubs in Bruges, and I wanted a particular beer, and they said, well, we've got the beer, but we don't have the glass. And they were apologetic, and they actually thought I would want to change beers because they didn't have the right glass. But I said, you know, you can use whatever glass you want. But I guess for a Belgian connoisseur, the glass makes a
difference. It also goes the other way around. If you order a beer and they serve it in a different glass, the customer can say, I'm sorry, you know, this is not how I ordered it.
Well,
that's a nice wall to see with... all the Belgian beers, you can buy them and then try them in the spot itself.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Nico Favaril. We're celebrating Bruges. It's one of the most beautiful little towns in Europe. Nico, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. When you're on a road trip, you can listen to Travel with Rick Steves on one of more than 500 other radio stations. You'll find a list of where and when at ricksteves.com/radio.